Hi, so good afternoon. I wasn't able to be here this morning, so I didn't participate in the usual round the room thing. So I'm a senior lecturer in Crest, and the work I'm going to talk about today I've been doing with Jens and Mark and Dave Bickley, who many of you know. And a lot of my work now, many of you may know me from software engineering work, a lot of the work I'm doing now is in digital humanities and arts, and particularly in music systems and music analysis. And to some extent, that's what I'm going to talk about today. Now, I was going to get you to exercise your imagination at the start of this talk, and I was going to say, imagine yourself in a darkened room. However, you don't really need to imagine it. We're in a fairly dark, well, those of you in this half are in a fairly dark room, those in the back have plenty of light. So imagine you're in a darkened room, and you're sat there, there's a long bench, and you're sat on this bench, and over here, a big space, lots of small boxes. And as you're sitting on this bench, in silence, a voice speaks. It says, I am. And then another voice speaks and it says, I am 23, I am 18. And so these voices start to build until eventually you're surrounded by them. They're coming from in front of you, behind, from each side. These voices are building and there's clicks and there's music and this kind of thing. Into this strange sort of sonic environment. So you have this big texture and you're sat in this room. Now the reason I'm telling you this, I'm trying to get you to imagine this, is because I couldn't find a good video clip of the particular art installation I'm describing. It's a piece called Listening Post by Mark Hansen and Ben Rubin. One of them is a statistician at a university in the US, and one of them is an artist. And we see here a picture of Listening Post. So the bench in here would be about there. And you have all these screens. And around it, you can just see in the background here, are speakers. There's 32 speakers in this installation. And what this does is it harvests text from internet chat rooms. And then each of these acts as an agent, and they search for similar text around them. And eventually they lock onto a text. And the text scrolls across, and sometimes it's read through a text-to-speech engine. This was done with some backing from Lucent Technologies, so they use the Lucent text-to-speech engine. And then there's some music that goes on in the background, and it's generated on the basis of the text and the patterns of the text that are used here. I was lucky enough to see this. This was part of an exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum and Science Museum earlier this year called Decode, which was a whole set of pieces of digital art. The reason I'm telling you this is because underlying this system, at least part of it, is a program written in a language called MaxMSP. MaxMSP is quite often used for this kind of experimental music, installation art, that kind of thing. It's a music and data programming language. If you get the chance to go and see Listening Post, then I thoroughly recommend it. It is a spectacular installation. So this talk is really about finding clones in MaxMSP patches, which was a kind of an experimental idea. We thought we could see whether we could do it, what the issues might be involved in finding these clones. And we found we needed to develop some small extensions really on clone detection to allow us to do this successfully, and I'll come on to explain why. One of the reasons we might want to find clones, apart from just the general interest that this is a new kind of programming language we haven't looked at, I should say MaxMSP isn't new, it's been around since the early 70s. It's still produced by a company called Cycling 74. The person who invented it originally, Miller Puckett, is now developed an open source version, if you like, of it called Pure Data, which is freely available. MaxMSP is quite expensive to license. So one of the reasons we might be interested in looking at this from an application point of view is because the distance, if you like, between the specification of a notation, for want of a better word, of the music, and its production is much reduced in a programming language like this. So if we write a traditional piece of music, we write the notation, and then there's a huge amount of work done by the performer in interpretation of that music as they render it into sound. That distance is to some extent reduced when we deal with this because as we write code in the language, we are effectively in a position to directly produce sound. So we thought it may be possible to generate methods for looking at music similarity by looking at the similarity between clones and the kind of sounds that might be produced from particular fragments of code. There are potentially options for helping with managing patch libraries. We've got lots of these Max MSP patches, we want to be able to cluster them, and one way to do that might be based on their content. We may also, my iPad's got carried away, he thinks we're at the end of the talk. We may also want to support composers by a kind of code completion for composers, if you like. We can start developing a patch, and then based on what we found and similar fragments in our clone library, we might be able to suggest things they might do at that point. So, what does a Max MSP patch look like? Here is a very simple Max MSP patch. This one is designed to do nothing more exciting than divide 12 by 4. I'll explain how Max MSP works and why this particular Max MSP patch won't actually divide 12 by 4. So there are some basic things to explain about the syntax. We have these message lines, which is what messages flow along. We have objects, in this case we have three numbers. We have a notion of hot and cold inputs, so inputs at the top here are hot, which means that when something arrives at that input, an output is immediately produced. The operation happens and an output is produced. These are cold inputs on the right-hand side, so the value arrives and is stored there. Message ordering in Max, and this is where we needed to adapt one or two things. Message ordering is right to left, top to bottom, and I'll illustrate this now. So this patch will only start operating when we click on the circle here, and that issues what's known as a bang message. And that simply sends the bang to here, and a bang arriving there causes the value to be sent from here to there. And if you notice, this arrives on the hot input. So as soon as this arrives, we undertake the division. Max doesn't allow you to do division by zero, so although this may look like a division by zero operation, Max won't do that, it'll do 12 divided by 1. So we get 12 out of there, and we have our result. And it comes down and it's printed. But we haven't finished yet, because we still have more messages to send. So we send a bang message to 3, which arrives here at the addition operation on cold input, so it just waits. And we get the 1, and now, because that's a hot input, we do 1 plus 3, we get 4. And 4 is transmitted to here on the cold input, but there's nothing left to do. We've already been through here, there are no more messages. We can't trigger anything else to happen here because it's cold. So arranged like this, our patch doesn't work. Gives us the wrong answer for what we want. If we rearrange the patch positionally, but not topologically, we can do this. So we still have the same connections here. The 12 is still connected to the hot input on our division operation. But if we now look at the message sequence, we have 3 coming into the cold input, 1 comes down and gets added to 3, giving us 4. 4 comes to the cold input, so at that point we don't do anything else. The bang comes through 12, 12 divided by 4 gives us 3, and we have the right answer. So the point I'm making here, apart from trying to give you some insight into why Max is a rather complex programming language to get your head around when you're trying to do something relatively simple, is that position matters. The position of the objects matters. The topology is not... you can leave the topology alone, if you change the position, you'll get a different result. So, that's not the kind of clone I was expecting. Those of you who can see my iPad, should be able to see the slide that's supposed to be on the screen. This is something to do with moving from a Mac to a PC. The top of this diagram here is the diagram I'm supposed to be looking at. I was trying to show you an example of a clone. Instead, we've got this nice piece of Microsoft graphical interface. So, I should move on from that. So we're seeking essentially sub-fragments of these. We could try and do one from here. We could identify this, let's say, as a clone candidate against the other version of our patch. Yeah. So we're looking effectively for a sub-patch or sub-graph up to a patch of these things. You can nest patches in Max MSP, so one box on here may actually represent a whole sub-patch. As our algorithm implementation stands at present, we don't dive into that level. It could be done, but at the moment we don't have an implementation that does that. So as part of doing this, we tried to come up with a way of describing the kinds of clones we might get, largely following the traditional textual clone classification. So we defined a kind of data flow zero type, which is an exactly copied framework in every respect. Exactly the same position, same contents, same topology, everything. For DF1, we defined it as the equivalent of the same but with changes in white space. So here, that means you could move the objects around, but not to change their relative order. Yeah.
Have you got some sort of graph grammar describing the language?
No. That would be very helpful if we had, and I did look for some time to find some kind of specification. But no, there isn't anything for Max. It's a case of figuring it out based on...
So how did you actually do the matching?
By reading the patch definitions. I'll come on, actually, can I come on to that next slide, the algorithm. DF1 was changes in white space. DF2 allows us to also change literal values. Comments, I mean, we've included comments here for completeness. Actually, comments in Max just appear as a text box somewhere on canvas. They don't really get linked in any way to the data. And then type DF3 is kind of, you can change anything at all and call it a claim. We focused on types 0 to 2 for our sort of preliminary investigation. How we actually do the matching, we do some pre-processing. So we parse and uniquely identify each box in the patch. The patches are stored in plain text files. It's not too difficult to parse them. They're stored in the JSON format. So alongside retaining information such as what sort of an object is this, how many inputs does it have, how many outputs does it have, because although I've shown you some quite simple ones there, some of the Max objects can have sort of 8 or 9, 10 inputs and a similar number of outputs. And you can connect multiple data lines out of each output as well. But critically, we retain where it is on the canvas. That's the kind of additional step that we're doing here. We then do some candidate generation. So for each patch line, we follow it as far as we can without creating a cycle in the graph, because you can have cycles in a Max patch. And we're doing that linearly, so we're not at the moment creating fragments, we're creating sort of lines of possible data flow. And then for clone detection, we do a fairly simple and fairly naive algorithm at this stage, where we compare each member of the candidate path pool with all the others. So there's not a huge amount of efficiency going on here, but we're not talking about vast amounts of stuff to parse, because patches, although they can be quite complex in their behaviour, are they're not as big as we might expect to see, for example, for a traditionally written software system. We'll be doing this on millions of lines of code. It's unlikely we'll find that. And then we classify them by starting by saying, is it the least restrictive one? So the object types match, the port numbers match, so we've got the same topology of the graph, and the relative positions match, even if the absolute percentage is not the same. A DF1 clone would be seen as a DF2, and there's matching of the literal values in the boxes, and a DF0 clone is the same thing, but we actually have exactly the same absolute difference in position. So, when we started this work, I anticipated it would be very easy to find huge amounts of Max code out on the internet because people are generally quite a supportive community. And there is a lot of code out there for Max, but because Max allows the writing of externals in other languages that then just appear as a box in there, when we actually came to look at the case study material, it turned out that almost all the code we could find was in fact a single box with a large like C++ sitting behind it, which of course wasn't much use for what we wanted. So, what we did to get some results, to get some sense of if this was worth doing and so on, was we looked at the tutorial set. Max comes with quite a good set of documentation with a large number of patches in it, fairly large number of patches. So we ran it on the tutorial set, which is 43 patches in one group. And I wouldn't necessarily expect to see a lot of cloning there, because of course the patches are designed to teach you different things. So they're not trying to sort of build incrementally. Some patches are going to be telling you about creating sound, others will be teaching you about how to manage graphics on the screen and so on. You wouldn't expect to see necessarily a huge amount of cloning. So we need 43 patches, which is 1,881 top-level boxes with 1,790 lines. It would have been bigger had we been able to pass the sub-patches. But time pressure meant we didn't finish the implementation to do that. We got enough results from where we were here. But I mean, it could be done. And we set our maximum clone size at 10 boxes. Only then we never found a clone as big as that. So, a few results from this. We did find some, which was good. This is the same data presented twice, basically. So, not surprisingly, what we find is that the less restrictive we are on what a clone there is, the more of them we find. And we find quite a lot in some cases. We also thought it would be interesting to see whether this was coming from a very small number of places. So we wanted to look to see whether we had, or how many unique elements, how many unique boxes were taking part in clones. And it's quite a large amount actually for a DF2. More than two-thirds of the code elements in the patches participate in cloning relationships. And I was quite surprised by that. I didn't think we'd see anything like that much in a patch set that's not really all targeted at the same sort of domain. If we have a set of patches all aimed at MIDI processing or something. Yeah.
So, pardon my ignorance here. By patches, you mean a sound sample and you're doing...
A patch is a collection of boxes and lines, like the thing I saw showed you.
Okay, so I know a little bit about MIDI, and I think of patches being a sound sample. And
yes, I know why. Yes, the term is used in synthesis. A patch would be exactly what you're saying. Yes,
so it's not that.
It's not that. No, okay. A patch in MaxMSP. It's derived from the same root, in that both derived from the days when you used patch leads to connect together things. But in Max, the model is extended to data essentially, and so you patch together operational objects through these data lines. And Pure Data takes that even more explicitly further and just says everything's data. So it may come out of here as a MIDI note, but over here you can call it a sound wave if you want to. It places fewer restrictions on it. I also found this was quite surprising that the DF1 clone, so this requires literal values to match, was as high as it was. I mean, we're talking about a third of the elements are matching even at that level. I don't expect you to read this. In fact, this is not the whole graph, and there are three of these, but I wanted to give you some idea of some stuff we've done. I can give you this on paper if you want, but it's not practical to try and show this on the slide. Essentially, what we were looking for was how the clones distributed across our set of files that we were working on, and how often did they get cloned within the file versus the clone found outside the file. What we found was that as the clone criteria becomes more relaxed, we were finding more fragments outside the files. Outside the patch we were looking at, so we found more cross-patch cloning, if you like, the less restricted we were about what a clone is. So a kind of an application of that, if you like, is that in supporting composers using Max, if we were trying to give them some sort of suggestions of, okay, you've developed this much of your patch, what about these ways to extend it? It would suggest that using DF2 clones is probably the most helpful one. We've got three of this graph, one for DF0, one for DF1, DF2. Because the chances are the patch you've got in front of you can see where the clones are. And what you want to do is be given information about what other sources of stuff you might have out there. So, in terms of where we go next, one obvious thing to do is to put together an algorithm for combining clone fragments. So instead of just having single lines through the patch, we can actually start to build the largest possible subgraph we can do. I want to retarget it to pure data.